From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. Today we examine work done at the Ames Laboratory. The lab was formally established in 1947 and sprang from the Manhattan Project, the World War II program, to develop the first atomic bombs. During the Cold War era and before, workers at the Ames Laboratory may have been exposed to several cancer-causing toxic substances. Today we speak with the widow of an Ames Lab worker who was denied compensation, a doctor who regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure, and we'll talk with representatives from the Ames Laboratory itself today to find out what's going on there now. The legacy of the Ames Laboratory. First This News. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Glad to have you with us over this noon hour. And today we examine the work and health legacy of the Ames Laboratory. The Ames Laboratory was formally established in the 1940s. It sprang from the Manhattan Project, the World War II program to develop the first atomic bombs. Today, the Ames Laboratory is a government-owned, contractor-operated research facility of the U.S. Department of Energy that is run by Iowa State University, and the lab now pursues a broad range of scientific priorities. Later in the program, we are going to talk with the current director of the Ames Laboratory, Alex King, along with Tom Wessels, manager of Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance Office at the Ames Laboratory. We'll talk with them about the history of the lab in depth and the work that the lab is doing these days. But first of all, we want to discuss that the fact that during the Cold War era and before that in the 1940s, workers at the Ames Laboratory may have been exposed to several cancer-causing toxic substances. Tomorrow, the Advisory Board for Radiation and Workers' Health, run by the Center for Disease Control, is meeting in Idaho. Part of that agenda is to deliberate on two issues concerning the Ames Laboratory. Joining us now, Bo Fellinger, the widow of an Ames Lab worker who has been denied compensation. Bo Fellinger joins us from her home in Colorado. Good afternoon to you, Bo.
Good afternoon.
Also joining us, Dr. Maureen Merritt, who regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure. Dr. Merritt is a native Iowan, retired physician with the U.S. Public Health Service, an occupational doctor who is now an advocate assisting claimants in the nuclear weapons industry. She founded the first in the nation state office of nuclear worker advocacy in New Mexico, also founder of the New Mexico Alliance of Nuclear Workers. Dr. Maureen Merritt joins us this afternoon from New Mexico. Good afternoon, doctor.
Good afternoon.
Let me start with Bo Fellinger. Tell us when your husband worked at the Ames Laboratory and the nature of his work.
He worked in the late 60s to early 70s. He was a research assistant for the professors at Iowa State University.
He was a student at that time?
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. But he was a paid research assistant. That was how he was putting himself through school, along with the GI Bill. And his field was high-energy physics.
Okay, so tell us more about the nature of his work. What substances would he have been working with?
I'm not really clear on that. My husband was an uber geek, and he did not talk a great deal about his work. I do know that he was in the labs and that he was at the National Accelerator Labs, now known as Fermi Labs, and at Argonne National Labs as well.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what substances he worked with.
And that's an important point that you just mentioned there, because he was not only at the Ames Lab with potentially harmful substances, but also in these other areas in his work.
That's correct.
Okay. According to the claim documents, I see that your husband was likely exposed to beryllium, known to cause chronic lung disease. Is that the basis of your claim?
We suspect that that is what happened, yes.
Okay, beryllium, a radioactive substance.
It's also toxic to the lungs.
Okay. When did your husband get sick?
His first illness was when he was 50 years old. So that would have been, 1996.
Mm-hmm. What were his symptoms?
He became ill with the flu and then had a severe reaction in his lungs that the doctors could not understand. He was hospitalized for a month, almost died, before they could conquer the pneumonia and get him back out of the hospital again. And even then, he had to use oxygen for a while.
Mm-hmm. What diagnosis did they eventually arrive at?
When he became sick again at the age of 60, no, late 50s, I guess it was, the diagnosis that they finally arrived at was idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Idiopathic because they did not understand what its origin was.
Idiopathic simply means we don't know the origin of it, right?
Basically, right.
Mm-hmm.
Unique to this individual, we don't know.
Mm-hmm. At what point did you and your husband get the idea that the illness might have something to do with Michael's work?
We didn't even think about it until Michael received a communication from the Department of Labor about this claims process, talking about illness in former nuclear workers. And the light bulb sort of went off at our heads at that point.
Mm-hmm. What year would that have been?
Probably around 2004.
Dr. Merritt, I know you're aware of the Fellinger case, but I want you to please put this in a broader context. How many cases are there like this one, the case of Michael Fellinger?
You mean at the Ames Lab or in general across the nation?
Well, can you speak to both aspects?
Well, I really don't have the numbers for the Ames Lab, although Dr. Fortas, who is the director of the former worker screening program at University of Iowa, would have that information. My understanding is there were quite a number of ill nuclear workers from Ames. My experience with other facilities around the country, it's not uncommon for folks to have worked at these various DOE and AWE facilities to end up with lung diseases and other illnesses as a result of their exposures. And beryllium is just one of the things that can cause a fibrotic lung condition.
Mm-hmm. So this, when we're talking about the science and the connection of what workers at the Ames Lab were brought in contact with and the ailments, is the science, how solid is the science there, causal?
Well, okay. The science, the medicine and science of the various toxins and the illnesses that they can cause is fairly clear. There are always, in particular with chemical exposures, there's always some question because it's an evolving toxicology and environmental medicine is an evolving science. But it's pretty clear by now after, 60, 70 years of research on these various ionizing radiation and toxic chemical heavy metals that are used in these facilities, that they are indeed capable of causing cancers and many other illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
So the science is there. However, if you're talking about causation specifically, under the EEOI-CPA, which is the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Act, then that begins to be quite an issue.
Mm. Continue with your story, Bo Fellinger, with you and your husband. So what came next when you became aware of claims for compensation? What happened? This is in the 90s?
Yes. No, it was in the early 2000s.
Okay.
We received this information, and my husband was, by this point, permanently on oxygen, and he began the process of getting the medical data together that he needed for the claims process. And in that process, while he was doing that, he was contacted by Dr. Fortas, at the University of Iowa and learned of all the other cases that were very similar to his.
Okay, and then you filed for compensation, and how long after that filing did you receive any word?
It was many months after he had finished the filing, and in fact, the day that I received the first notice saying he would be denied was the day that he died.
That was in what year?
That was in 2008.
What was the basis of the denial by this office?
They have given me several bases, all of which have been refuted by experts in the field. One they gave me was that it took too long between his possible exposure back in the early 70s and the beginning of the illness. Another one was that the illness dragged on too long. He should have died much more quickly than that. They could not get a positive beryllium test on him, but that was because he was on high doses of prednisone to block his immune response.
We have about a minute before we need to take a break. Dr. Merritt, do you see these as legitimate points of contention that Bo Fellinger received from your point of view as a doctor?
I was involved. I was asked to assist with this claim, actually, by Dr. Fortes, who was being frustrated by these various denials and the rationale behind it. And I had to agree with Dr. Fortes that it was pretty clear that his potential exposures at the Ames lab during his work years would have exposed him to, and you can look up on the Ames lab website and find that these things are listed, asbestos, silica, beryllium, many chemicals including solvents and heavy metals, along with ionizing radiation from things such as uranium, thorium, plutonium, and uranium decay products, all of which can cause some of these lung conditions. So idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis is a very rare diagnosis in people in general.
We have to take a short break, and we'll come right back talking to Dr. Maureen Merritt, who regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure. Also, Bo Fellinger, the widow of an Ames lab worker seeking compensation. Do you have questions about this case, about the Ames laboratory? Do you have a connection with the Ames Laboratory? Tell us your story. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. We're on Twitter at IPR Talk. Back in 1 minute. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we'll talk with the current director of the Ames Laboratory, Alex King, also the manager of Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance Office at the Ames Laboratory, Tom Wessels. Bring us up to date on what the Ames Laboratory is doing today. Also, we'll delve back into history and find out about the origins, the genesis of the Ames Laboratory in the Manhattan Project. Right now, we're talking with the widow of an Ames Lab, former Ames Lab worker who is seeking compensation. Michael Fellinger worked as a graduate student in high-energy physics at the Ames Laboratory in the 1960s, early 1970s. Bo Fellinger is his widow. He passed away in 2008, and Bo Fellinger has been trying to seek compensation. Also joining us, Dr. Maureen Merritt, who regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure. Join our conversation with your questions or comments, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we left off, Dr. Merritt, you were talking about the connection between exposure to beryllium and so forth and incidents of lung cancer. So in the denial of this by the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program that Bo Fellinger received, Does it seem to you that this program is looking for a way to deny the claim?
Well, that would be a strong statement. I can't say for certain that there's a concerted effort to look for an excuse to deny the claim, but what I can tell you is that historically, under this program, which was implemented by Congress in 2001, two-thirds of claims have been denied on average, and only one-third paid. And in some cases, there's a Part B and Part E. This particular claim of Mr. Fellinger's would be under Part E, and that one, the statistics are even more miserable, frankly. It's probably less than 30% paid. So we, as medical experts and physicians, other folks that are advocates under the program assisting claimants because of how complicated and complex and arbitrary it is, it would seem at times that there is an effort to deny claims, to hold down costs. However, and then there is an OMB passback memo of several years ago that actually detailed this information and prompted a congressional investigation of the program. And I believe we're probably headed for another one now.
Bo Fellinger, what do you want in terms of compensation at this point?
And you mean monetarily?
Sure, if you're able to mention that.
I really don't have any number in mind, but I do think they need to admit that this was, in fact, caused by his employment there. This illness is incredibly rare in the population, and it's many orders of magnitude more common amongst the Ames Labs workers.
I understand you received a denial to reopen this case from the Energy Employees Occupational Illness Compensation Program just a few weeks ago, and you have asked Senator Tom Harkin to get involved in this case. He is now involved. He has written a letter. Describe what he's doing.
He wrote to them a letter explaining that the reasons given for the denial of my husband's claim do not match current medical opinion. So far, they have not responded to his letter.
So you have seen no movement change since Senator Harkin wrote this letter last month?
That's correct.
What are your hopes that will happen here in the coming weeks? And I want to talk to Dr. Merritt about that, too.
I'm hoping that someone will convince them to listen to actual current medical opinion of experts in the field that they're talking about. They refused to listen to the current expert knowledge in the field.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Merritt, are those your hopes?
Well, of course. I would hope that Mrs. Fellinger gets her compensation as she should have. Long ago by now. I do feel that the DOL, Department of Labor, seems to dig in its heels at times when these claims are contested with good science and well-rationalized medical opinions, which I provided along with Dr. Fortas and three other experts in the field, including, you know, pathologists from Mayo Clinic and so forth, and current literature. If I may mention that there are a couple of issues here in this case. One is the standard of causation proof is too high. The Department of Labor is holding claimants to too high a standard. The language in the law under Part E states that you can determine with reasonable certainty that it's as likely as not that this illness was caused by, contributed to, or aggravated by his exposure at work. Mm-hmm. That is not being followed. We believe that the causation, they're treating as a straight line causation between exposure of toxins and illness, and that's not the standard by law. So that's one problem. Okay.
Mm-hmm. The standard of causation. The other. We have about 3 minutes left.
Okay.
The other standard.
The other issues are that there has not been a medical director for this program in over a year, and therefore there isn't anyone that oversees the various district medical consultants' opinions. And we are calling for, and by that I mean other advocates and authorized representatives, folks around the country with knowledge of this are asking for a DOL oversight committee so that there is an expert committee or panel that can oversee the activities of these DMCs. They need to be more closely vetted and oversight so that these type of things don't happen.
How do you see your chances in getting these changes?
I think that they're fairly good because we had a report just come out this year from the GAO, Government Accounting Office, that was ordered by Congress. And amongst the suggestions about the changes that need to occur in this program, that's one of their prime ones, is that we do need an oversight board or committee, much like the ABRWH that you mentioned earlier, the Advisory Board of Radiation Worker Health, that oversees special exposure cohorts and other things with these facilities around the country. So we're cautiously hopeful that this is going to happen. Meanwhile, I'm told that there is a medical director that they are in the process of interviewing and finalizing, but as of today, to my knowledge, hasn't been seated yet. But that may be helpful so that we can, these type of cases that are contested, there shouldn't be a top-level non-medical, non-science administrator being the final arbiter of this claim. I have a serious problem with that.
In the minute or so we have remaining, address the nuclear power, not in the past, but in the future. We're seeing, of course, renewed interest in nuclear power, may have at some point the first nuclear power plants built in this country in many years. Dr. Merritt, how do you view the possibility of new nuclear power plants being built? Are we into an era of safer designs, safer procedures for workers who are in these types of facilities?
Well, most certainly we are in safer environment, safer designs than they were 30 or 40 years ago, or in the early days of our weapons production, let's say. There was, you know, huge amounts of exposure and very little knowledge at the time of the damage it could do. I give these facilities, including nuclear reactor facilities, credit for, you know, cleaning up their act, so to speak. However, there still is a considerable element of risk associated with working in these facilities, and we can't ignore that.
Dr. Maureen Merritt, please stay with us. You'll be with us into the next half hour. Dr. Merritt regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure. We want to say thank you very much to Bo Fellinger, who's joining us from Colorado, the widow of an Ames lab worker, Michael Fellinger, who died in 2008, and she is still seeking compensation. We grieve your loss with you, Bo Fellinger, and I want to say we're very appreciative of you joining our conversation this hour.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back on The Exchange, we'll talk with the current director of the Ames Laboratory, Alex King, also the manager of the Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance Office at the Ames Laboratory, Tom Wessels. Your questions, comments about what's going on at the Ames Laboratory these days, also questions about its past, 1-866-780-9100. Perhaps you or a loved one have been involved with work that later turned out to have detrimental health implications, and you'd like to share that. 1-866-780-9100 or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. We'll be back in just a few minutes. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour tomorrow at this time. It's Politics Day. Yes, I didn't make a mistake. Politics Day, moving to The Exchange over the noon hour. And tomorrow we'll talk about the new campaign by former gubernatorial candidate Bob Vanderplaats to oust three Iowa Supreme Court justices. Now, this move is in response to the 2009 ruling that legalized same-sex marriage in Iowa, this move by Vanderplaats. Share your thoughts and questions on this and other matters of state or national politics with our analysts tomorrow, Wednesday at noon, Politics Day on The Exchange. Today, we're examining the work and the health legacy of the Ames Laboratory. The Ames Lab was formally established in the 1940s. It sprang from the Manhattan Project. That's the World War II program developed to to develop the first atomic bombs. In the first half hour, if you were with us, we discussed how workers at the Ames laboratory may have been exposed to several cancer-causing toxic substances during the Cold War era. We spoke with the widow of Michael Fellinger. She is seeking compensation for disease that was, they claim, caused by work at the Ames laboratory. Now we want to talk about to the Ames laboratory today. It's a government-owned, contractor-operated research facility of the U.S. Department of Energy. It's run by Iowa State University. For more than 60 years, the Ames Laboratory has sought solutions to energy-related problems through the exploration of chemical engineering materials, mathematical and physical sciences. The lab now pursues a broad range of scientific priorities. Joining us more now to discuss more about the work at the lab today and also in the past, Alex King, the current director of the Ames Laboratory, from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Good afternoon to you, Alex King.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Also with us, Tom Wessels, the manager of Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance Office at the Ames Laboratory. Tom Wessels, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Also still with us, Dr. Maureen Merritt. If you heard in the first program, first half hour of our program, she regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure, founded the first in the nation state office of nuclear worker advocacy in New Mexico, founder of the New Mexico Alliance of Nuclear Workers. She's joining us by phone from New Mexico. And Alex King, let me turn to you. Tell us a little bit more about the history of the lab. It was born of part of the Manhattan Project. How did it fit in to the efforts to create the first atomic bombs?
Well, Frank Spedding was a professor at Iowa State University back in the 1940s, and he had invented a process for purifying uranium. He was asked by the government to use that process to provide uranium that was eventually used in the atomic bomb. At that time, or during that process, the Ames lab purified, I think, 2 million pounds of uranium, most of which went on to other labs to be enriched and to have the radioactive components extracted and converted into weapons-grade material.
So, in any of the test bombs or the bombs that were dropped at Nagasaki, Hiroshima, was any product from the Ames Laboratory in any of those bombs?
That's impossible to tell. There's a lot of this which is still classified, and we don't know where all the other sources of uranium were, but I would guess it's quite likely that at least the first bomb, which was a uranium bomb, actually contained material that started out here in Ames.
After the war, as we went into the Cold War period, what happened to the Ames Laboratory then? How did its role evolve?
The Ames Lab supported the Department of Energy in many ways, but mostly it started out by parlaying its expertise in the purification of metals into purifying a whole range of additional metals after uranium. The uranium process was actually commercialized and handed off to the public sector.
Metals that were not necessarily radioactive?
In many cases, not. Some cases, yes. But Ames Lab today is still known for its ability to provide the purest samples of what are called rare earth metals, which are not radioactive.
Mm-hmm. And that period lasted throughout the Cold War. And into this day, or how has it evolved further?
It's hard to say, really, how things evolve. I've only been at the Ames Lab for 2 years, so I'm not exactly steeped in the history. But Ames Lab has moved with the times and over the years has focused on the topics that are of most interest to the Department of Energy and to the government.
Alex King, if we were to be allowed to visit the Ames Laboratory, which brings up a good question, is are people allowed? Is it under sort of top secret or any sort of clearance that not ordinary people can come into it?
No, in fact, the Ames Lab is the most accessible of all of the Department of Energy's national labs. Department of Energy runs 17 national labs. We're one of them. We're the only one where you can walk right up to the building and push the door and walk in.
Okay, so let's walk in here on the radio and tell us what we would see.
If you walked into any of our labs, you'd walk into a building which would have just the standard sort of look of a laboratory building. It has hallways and offices and labs behind doors. Some of the labs have fairly exotic equipment in them. Some of them have some rather mundane chemical or physical science kinds of facilities that you might find in any lab anywhere in the country.
Talk more about the role of the Ames Lab right now. What is being produced there that may concern our individual lives, make our lives better?
That's a great question. The Ames Lab today prides itself on its ability to invent and work with and understand new materials. Does other things too, but new materials are our main product. If you have a cell phone, if you have a computer, you should take it out and look at it and say thank you to the Ames Lab, because all of the components of your cell phone and your computer are held together with solder. And a few years ago, Europe and Japan banned the use of lead-bearing solder in electronics because when those are disposed of and sent to landfills, the lead leaches out and gets into the environment. Ames Lab invented a lead-free solder that is now used in all electronics all the way around the world. So we're developing things that really do make the world a better place to live in.
Is that something patented by the Ames Laboratory, that new type of solder?
Yes, indeed it is. Mm-hmm.
Tom Wessels, let me turn to you because you are the manager of Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance Office at the Ames Laboratory. Of course, our first half hour, we talked about the Ames Lab's history in dealing with some substances that prove to be potentially harmful. What are the biggest risks that workers would potentially face at the Ames Lab these days? I know you have safeguards in place, but what materials there are potentially dangerous?
I think our hazards would be more standard than to what is in a typical chemistry laboratory. So depending on the individual experiments, there may be some chemicals that have hazardous nature, but we have much more thorough control strategies than were implemented during the 1940s.
Give me a specific material that you would say, I don't want to have direct contact with that, for instance, that you have in your lab.
Let me talk about a new material, a new type, a class of materials that we're working with at the Ames Laboratory, and that's the nanoscale materials. And that's a type of material that has somewhat less known about the hazards than many of the other chemicals that we've worked with in the past because of its finely divided nature. And we've instituted through the Department of Energy's rigorous safety requirements some control strategies that have assured our workers that they are not subjected to unknown hazard nature of the nanoscale materials.
Nanoscale materials. What is a nanoscale material?
Oh, it's very, very small. I think 10 to the minus 9 meter, 10 to the minus 9th.
Uh-huh.
So it's extremely small-scale materials, and you've seen it in the popular press that it's used for some sort of machine-type, micro-machine-type applications. It's got great application in the delivery of medical.
So these are the materials that may be engineered to produce machines that will troll through our veins and so forth.
There you go. Yeah, that's the type of stuff that we're talking about. And the interesting thing about it is that the hazards are a little bit more unknown, but we've had significant strategies developed to control any potential exposure. So that's a type of material that we probably over-engineer the controls for simply because we don't have a thorough understanding of the nature of the hazards. And at the same time, we're trying to keep up with the science of what the industry is developing for the hazards, what they're learning about, what the medical community is learning about the hazards.
Tom Wessels, Manager of Environmental Safety, Health, and Assurance at the Ames Laboratory. Alex King, the current director of the Ames Laboratory, with us. Also joining us by phone, Dr. Maureen Merritt, regularly works with victims of radiation and toxic substance exposure. She was with us during the first half hour as well. And you're on the line with us from New Mexico, Dr. Merritt. When you hear the work of the Ames Laboratory these days and Tom Wessels talk about the overabundance, as he sees it, of safety there, what issues, what questions come to your mind? Do you have concerns?
I think that based on what I know of the Ames Lab, they do have a very vigorous safety program in place. In fact, I do believe that the lab had just won a safety award, did they not, from the National Safety Council in 2009? Is that correct?
Alex King, tell us about that. I saw that on your website as well.
Yes, indeed. We just received an award from the National Safety Council. It's the Industry Leader Award, received actually just a few weeks ago, actually a week ago. It's a very nice glass ornament that sits on a credenza in the lab now. It's awarded to the top 5% of the member companies, units, facilities of the National Safety Council. And it's awarded basically in respect of having an excellent safety record, fewer accidents, fewer incidents per hour of time worked in the lab.
Mm-hmm. How has our, obviously when we go back and look at the case of Michael Fellinger, we looked in the early days of nuclear atomic programs in this country, a lot of unknowns there. How confident are we that, especially when we develop new materials, be they nanomaterials, that we aren't in unknown territory again and we aren't just guessing or having an idea that we're putting all the safety precautions in place that need to be? Is it possible there are safety issues we don't necessarily know about concerning nanomaterials or other materials, Alex King?
I think the prevailing philosophy is that we don't know everything there is to know about nanomaterials. And because we don't know, we make sure that there is as close to zero exposure to nanomaterials as there can possibly be. Mm-hmm. For many other materials, science has a history of discovering things as time goes by. What we try to do these days is keep excellent records of who has worked with what, so that when we encounter cases like the former worker program where a hazard emerges very much later on, we at least have the ability to go back and say who's been exposed, how they've been exposed, and what the likelihood is that they may have been exposed to something harmful.
Tom Wessels, now we mentioned before that the Ames Laboratory is one of 17 national labs. How closely do you work with other labs around the country in terms of keeping the safety up to standards that are as high as possible?
Well, I think we work quite closely and quite well together, especially with the Office of Science Laboratories. We would not work as closely with the larger defense-oriented type laboratories like possibly Los Alamos, although I have been to Los Alamos. We've used some of their expertise in several applications. We have typical exchange programs where we share information, lessons learned. The Department of Energy has an abundance of systems by which we report incidents and unusual occurrences so that we can all learn from the various events at other laboratories.
Dr. Maureen Merritt, tell us your thoughts about how you feel we best stay ahead of the curve in realizing what may be dangerous when we develop new technologies, new materials.
Well, I think some of what they've discussed is relevant in that we use an abundance of caution, especially with nanoparticles and some of the new technologies emerging, since we don't know what the risks are. I would suggest using an abundance of caution high levels of protective measures. And I need to hark back to one substance in particular as an example from our past and really our present as well. Beryllium has, you know, caused many illnesses, and commonly lung disease, fibrotic type lung disease, in workers that were unknowingly exposed over the years. It used to be 40 or 50 years ago, there was very little protection provided at these facilities. Now, we're more aware of it. However, at facilities such as Los Alamos and Ames Lab and others around the country, it's found that beryllium can hide out in various areas, and unless those areas are sought out and swipes done and tested, we don't know that people are being exposed. The science of beryllium disease, or borreliosis as it's called, is still evolving, and we find that it's an immunological problem, which ultimately can lead to cancer or death. And so I caution people that I work with to have a high level of suspicion and awareness of beryllium still being present in these facilities, even after certain buildings have been demolished. And the cleanup has been done. We still find that the beryllium can lurk even in rafters or in old mechanical parts of the building and that type of thing.
Alex King, do you believe that it's possible that there's beryllium lurking in your laboratory?
Oh, yes. In fact, we know there is. As part of a maintenance project that we intended to start a little more than a year ago, we did what we routinely do, which is we checked out the area involved, and we were dismayed to find some beryllium in some of the surface swipes that we did. That actually resulted in a very large project to identify where the beryllium is, make sure that it is not in any place where anybody can have contact with it. And if we find anywhere there is the possibility of human contact, we clean it up.
How long does beryllium stay hazardous?
Forever. Mm-hmm. It is not a radioactive material. It's a poisonous material.
Mm-hmm. Do you still work with radioactive materials in the Ames lab?
No, we don't have any work on radiation. There are, like any other lab, there is some use of radio tracer elements for certain kinds of studies. They're used as diagnostics or probes of other materials. But that is at a level which you would find in almost any chemistry facility around the world.
Dr. Merritt, how do you reconcile your work to help those who have suffered from radioactive materials, toxic materials, with the need to continue to do research with those dangerous materials? How do we find the balance? We can't rule out, I don't suppose, ever 100% when we're working, especially with new materials, new procedures, that there is no danger. How do you reconcile your work with the need to go forward?
Well, you're right. I think, you know, what you stated was that it is a delicate balance. We have to have the research facilities and production facilities such as Ames Lab and others around the country in order to further some of our, national priorities, including protection. But at the same time, we have to protect our workers and, you know, vigorous health and safety programs within these facilities is one really good way to do it so that we prevent as much exposure and thus illness as possible.
I understand, Dr. Merritt, you are part of an advisory committee for Cold War Patriots at coldwarpatriots.org. Explain what this group does.
Well, about 3 years ago, Cold War Patriots came into being because there was a loosely affiliated group of advocates and other, you know, people involved with the EEOICPA that realized that there was no voice for the average nuclear worker, particularly the workers that have become ill, to help them through this entire process, which tends to be rather complicated and, you know, beyond the capability of the average worker to wade through without assistance. So several of us got together and discussed this, and Cold War Patriots was born. It's a 501c3 nonprofit, and our goal is to help the nuclear workers around the country with various things such as their claims, health issues, home health care, speaking to Congress about changes that could be made to make this program more user-friendly.
Dr. Merritt, please, so we have contact information for you and also the Ames Lab. Let's start with you. Dr. Merritt, if people want to find out more about you and your work, they can find you where on the web?
I don't have an individual website, but you can find me on the web through Cold War Patriots.
ColdWarPatriots.org?
.org, yes.
Okay.
And the several of us will be on there. I'm on the advisory committee.
Okay,
along
very
with
good.
A couple of other physicians and other professionals, and we'll have contact information.
Thank you. And Alex King, director of the Ames Laboratory. How do people find out more about the Ames Lab?
www.ameslab.gov.
Alex King, director of the Ames Laboratory. Thank you. Tom Wessels of the Ames Laboratory. Thank you as well.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Maureen Merritt, joining us from New Mexico, thank you very much for your participation in this program. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Alex Hoyer, and Lindsay Moon. Production assistance today from Rosalind Sixby. This is Rosalind's last day. Many thanks, Rosalind, for the hard work on our talk shows over the past couple of years. Help today also from Michael Yeager in Ames. Podcasting and on-demand audio available by going to iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.